Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special fundraising edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. We've heard the horror stories, zebra mussels decimating the native clam population in the Great Lakes, the Asian longhorn beetles destroying trees here in the Northeast, nutria ravaging Louisiana's coastal marshes, and African killer bees on the attack in the Southwest. Invasive species are crisscrossing the globe and threatening biodiversity as we know it. Or are they? In his new book, Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasives Aren't All Bad, Dr. Ken Thompson argues that invasive species often cause far less damage than we might imagine, and that the cost of eradicating them often outweighs the benefits. Thompson was for 20 years a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield. Dr. Ken Thompson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi there.
Well, let's start with the question that you pose in the title of your book. Where do camels belong?
Well, I pose that question because it doesn't have a simple answer. Humans are very short-sighted kind of people. We never really look beyond, you know, the next election and quite often not beyond the end of next week, quite honestly. And so we assume that the way the world is today is the way it's always been. So we assume that something that's where it is now is where it's always been and where it should be. So most of your listeners won't know that camels evolved in North America and that there were dozens of species of camels that lived in North America for 40 million years and that they only went extinct in North America 8,000 years ago. So which is, you know, yesterday in geological time.
There were some definitions that were used back in the mid-19th century by a couple of notable British botanists who used this concept of native and alien when it came to species. Now, was this a scientific definition or was there something else at play here?
No, it was meant to be a scientific definition. They basically said if a species is where it is today and got there naturally on its own, then it's native. But if it was introduced by humans or in any way humans were involved in moving it to where it is now, then it's not native, then it's an alien. That was their definition. And that's really the definition we've stuck with ever since. We've kind of extended the sort of legal definition that we have in most countries of who is a legal citizen of that country.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tended to sort of extend that legal definition, you know, do you have the right kind of passport or not, to animals and plants. But they don't, you know, they haven't read the book, you know, they don't have passports.
It seems, though, that the definition of native changes depending on what is the perceived value of the species. In fact, you write about a British quote-unquote plant called Fritillaria meleagris. Tell us more about this plant.
Well, we have this particular problem in Britain because our entire flora and fauna only arrived here very recently at the end of the last ice age. and so we look at things and we often decide whether they're native or alien or not on the basis of whether we like them. So Fritillaria meleagris is a kind of conservation icon in Britain. It's a really pretty plant that grows in sort of hay meadows and things. And people spend lots of time conserving it. But in fact, it's really only been here a few hundred years, and it's a garden escape. It was originally brought into the country from Europe as an ornamental, but it's escaped into wild habitats, and now people use it as a kind of barometer of the value of those habitats because it's very attractive.
How far do you have to go back to establish belonging?
Well, exactly. Well, you tell me. I mean, I don't know. It depends what you're talking about, depends where you are in the world. I mean, you know, Australians are still having this argument among themselves about dingoes, you know. Are dingoes a native Australian animal or not, you know, because people took them to Australia, but that was about 5,000 years ago. So is that long enough? It depends very strongly on whether you like the plant or you like the animal.
Uh-huh, that's it. You point to in the book a beauty bias. Now, what do you mean by that? And how does that influence how we regard and how we talk about invasive species?
Well, we just adjust our definitions of what's native and alien, at least we do in this country, depending on what we like. So, I mean, almost all our arable weeds, our weeds of cereal crops in this country, are aliens because they were brought here by early farmers. So they were brought here by people. But because many of them are very attractive, things like poppies and so on, we tend to go around treating them as native. And there's nothing we like more as conservationists than as things that are pretty and rare. So we spend a lot of time conserving them. But they're not native.
So is our reaction to invasive species reactionary, or is something even more sinister? Is there a kind of xenophobia that goes with, you know, something came from the outside and it was probably carried by other people?
Yeah, I think maybe humans are basically xenophobic. Maybe our history means that we like people who are members of our family or of our immediate tribe, and we're just programmed to distrust or fear anyone or anything that isn't familiar, you know, and turns up unexpectedly.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Thompson. He's a longtime lecturer at the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield in England, now writes on gardening for the Daily Telegraph. And we're talking about his book, Where Do Camels Belong? It's a book questioning our beliefs and assumptions about invasive species. Are they all bad? Well, Dr. Thompson, you are, let's clarify that you are not advocating to welcome or accept all invasive species, or are you?
Oh, good Lord, no. I some people have criticized me for as though that's what I am saying, but I'm definitely not. I just think we should be a little more objective about this because, you know, a few alien species, you know, can be shown to cause real problems, real economic harm or real ecological harm. And those are the ones we should focus on. You know, we've only got enough, so much time and money to spend on this. Let's be honest, you know, we have more important things to worry about. And if we go around treating all alien species as though they need eradicating or controlling, then we're not going to do a very good job. We need to focus on the ones that really do cause a problem.
Well, how do we make that decision? Should we be more concerned about the recent invaders? I'm thinking of the zebra mussels or Asian carp or the long-horned Asian beetle here in New England than say, wild rabbits, which are a nuisance in England.
I don't think the time a species has been around has anything to do with it. I think we should just have some objective criteria where we add up the benefits and the problems that are caused by an alien species. You know, I mean, you mentioned zebra mussel now. Zebra mussels do a lot of good, quite honestly. We could go into details of exactly what they do.
Aren't they things that clog up pipes and can damage plumbing or stop it altogether?
Yeah, they can grow inside water pipes and things and cause a problem. But frankly, you know, there are fairly simple technical solutions for that. And in fact, they're great at filtering grot, you know, crud out of water. So they purify water. They're a great food source for water birds. They have a lot going for them, really.
But they killed off clams in many areas, haven't they?
Well, that's what people who don't like them claim. But, you know, the evidence for that is really quite poor, actually. And there's strong evidence that the clams that are declining were declining before the zebra mussel turned up. And mainly it's habitat change and it's pollution that's doing for the clams, not the zebra mussels.
We often focus on the ecological problems that invasive species cause. But in truth, are they man-made? Because that's often how they travel. You know, I guess I'm asking, have invasive species been scapegoated?
Oh, all the time. Many, many examples of where species are simply filling an ecological vacuum that's been caused by human activity. I mean, let's face it, mankind has completely transformed this planet. And to expect, quite honestly, that the species which lived in a particular place are going to be the ones best adapted to that spot now that mankind has changed it beyond recognition is frankly a little bit unreasonable, don't you think?
Any particular species come to mind that has been the most vilified?
Oh, the most vilified. Oh, heaven. Well, that depends entirely where you are.
Okay, there in the UK, let's say.
In the UK, you mentioned invasive species. people, if they're thinking of plants, they say Japanese knotweed. If you mention animals, most people would mention it. It's one of yours, I'm afraid. It's the American gray squirrel.
Mm.
That's the one people most hate.
All right. So we'll try and get over the anti-American bias of looking at the gray squirrel in that way. Well, in the book, you write about five myths about invasive species in which you refer to all of the species as aliens. Is there one in particular that really stands out for you as a myth that's led us down the wrong path?
The most important one, I suppose, was the idea that aliens are always amazingly expensive.
Hmm.
You know that they cost a lot of money. When I was researching this book, I found time and time again the costs that were attributed to an alien species were wildly exaggerated. They often never took account at all of any benefits of alien species, and the costs were often completely imaginary. The greater part of them was often costs spent on trying to control a species.
Hmm.
And although this should be obvious, but think about it for a moment. The costs of trying to control something cannot be a reason for trying to do that control in the first place.
What would be an example of that calculation?
Well, the example that I quote in the book is purple loosestrife.
This is a weed that's all over here in.
This
in
is
the
a
US.
Weed that's all over North America, and it's one of ours. It's very well behaved here, if you look that up, you can find various estimates. The usual estimate is, which is quite old now, so probably it's a bigger figure, but $45 million a year is apparently what it costs, what people spend every year on actually trying to control purple loosestrife. But there's no real evidence that a single cent of that is money well spent. In other words, I don't think anyone's ever shown that there would be less purple loosestrife if those $45 million were not spent. So whether that's a real cost or not can definitely be argued, I think.
Well, all right, you can keep your well-behaved purple loosestrife, and we'll try and contain our gray squirrels here in the U.S. I want to thank you for opening up a really interesting topic for us, Dr. Thompson.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Ken Thompson, he was for 20 years a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield. His previous book was called Do We Need Pandas? The Uncomfortable Truth About Diversity. Equally provocative, his newest book, Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasive Species Are Not All Bad. You can find more on both at wordofmouthradio.org.